Previously on Beta.
Is there a doctor in the house? Is there a doctor in the house?
I'm a doctor.
You're thinking about how you can turn this into a song, aren't you?
I said ball, I said ball, I said ball.
No, use your words, buddy. Use your words.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, Fargo creator Noah Hawley on his novel Anthem, a literary thriller that takes a frightening look at our fractured society.
I wanted it to be clear to the reader, you know, I'm worried, and I know you're worried. I'm worried about my kids, I'm worried about my country, and I know that you feel the same way.
Also, author Heidi Greco joins us to talk about one of the most unconventional romance movies ever made, Harold and Maude.
This film told me that it was okay to be weird, and it was okay to stand up for what you believe.
But first...
This flu kills everyone. We're all dead if they come inside here. Would you die for a stranger?
Probably not.
In early 2020, as most of the world retreated into quarantine, Emily St. John Mandel's novel Station 11 started popping up on popular reading lists, likely because Emily's novel was about surviving an apocalyptic flu and the parallels to COVID-19 were undeniable. It grappled with the very same questions we're asking ourselves today. Some felt that Emily was a prophet, but others found the setting of survivors making sense of an apocalypse a bit too soon for COVID-19 reading. HBO had already optioned the book for a limited series months before an actual pandemic hit the globe. Ironically, their production about a global pandemic had to be shut down because of our own pandemic with COVID-19. To adapt the novel, HBO turned to Green Bay's own Patrick Somerville. Patrick was the ideal candidate for the gig. Not only was he a novelist himself, but he cut his teeth in the writer's room for the critically acclaimed series The Leftovers. That show was also about surviving catastrophe and was created by Lost's Damon Lindelof. We caught up with Patrick to talk about his poetic and emotional adaptation of Station 11.
When I learned about adaptation, was working on a show called The Leftovers. The showrunner was Damon Lindelof and created by Damon. And the novelist who wrote the novel, The Leftovers, was Tom Perata. And very unusually, he was in the writer's room for seasons 2 and 3 after they had exhausted the material that was in the book. That's when I came, season 2. So I got to watch for 2 years what it looked like when a TV writer who had made 120 whatever episodes of Lost, you know, with cliffhangers and twists and turns and a lot of TV stuff, was in a dialogue with a novelist who was sort of protecting and maintaining the spirit of the novel that he had written. And to both of their credit, they were both so great at letting go. On Tom's case, sort of knowing that an idea that wasn't his was going into the story was okay, or something was going to change. And to Damon's credit, really listening when he thought something should go one way and Tom didn't, really listening to Tom, even though his TV instincts were saying, do this. So that was my training ground for adaptation.
Yeah, great training ground it is. And Station 11 is similar to the puzzle box and nonlinear style of Damon Lindelof's work on The Leftovers and The Watchmen. And you were, as you mentioned, you were on Damon's writing staff for The Leftovers. Is this a technique that was inspired by working with him?
I think who I am as a writer has a lot to do with that time I spent learning from Damon, because he was like a magical being. When I first started sitting in that room, it was kind of scary. Like, he could just pitch things, whole scenes. He would just talk them. And I was like, where is this coming from? He was just inventing it in real time. And I realized there was another level, I think, of screenwriting and TV writing that was fascinating to me. I will say, though, Station 11, the novel, already was nonlinear. And so I'm not a writer who needs to tell a story out of order. I just happened to learn about it from one of the best and also learn about it again from Emily's novel, because Station 11 needs to be out of time because it's about memory. And it's about before and after, not just one or the other. So we needed to tell the story in a way that let different timelines proceed together. For example, when you see Mackenzie Davis on stage working her way through Act One, Scene Two of Hamlet, the Seems speech, on the page, in the script, it was scripted as an intercut back to young Kirsten in the apartment, Kirsten, receiving those text messages.
Strangers,
Kirsten, what's going on? Open the door. Kirsten! Kirsten!
Tis not alone my inky cloak, good mother. Nor customary suits of solemn black. Nor windy suspiration of forced breath. Together with all moods, forms, shapes of grief that can denote me truly.
Weird texts.
There's got to be an emotional reason you're doing it. And in that case, it was Kirsten starting to remember a thing that she didn't like to think about or remember very often. I think everyone can relate to this, you know, whether you're on stage doing Hamlet or going to work driving up I-43. We all have memories that we haven't forgotten, but they're in boxes that we don't like to open. And so in that case, in episode two, it needed to happen in that way. They needed to be simultaneous, both to help us keep telling the story of what happened to that girl we met in the first episode, but also to help us start to know who the adult version of this person was.
Mm-hmm. Very well said. Both the novel and the series open with a production of King Lear, and the actor portraying Lear collapses on stage, and the character Jeevan jumps on stage. But you made a small tweak here from the novel. What was it?
Well, in the novel, Jeevan is a EMT in training, and I think his rush to the stage is somewhat motivated by a sense that he's the guy to help. He might know what to do. In our version, we decided to take that piece away, that EMT and training piece away. And I think at first blush, it might seem to make it make less sense, because why would you do that? For me as a storyteller, a couple things. I knew we were getting to episode 9, and episode 9 is the answer to that question. That's the beginning of a story that ends with episode 9, and so it's a long game for that story. But I also just very much relate to the feeling of wanting to help, having the instinct to help, positioning myself to help, and getting there and realizing I have no idea how to help. And I literally don't have the skill to be of service. So Jeevan, when we meet him in his life, is a guy who has great instincts about being a healer. Like a lot of people in our world, he is not trained. And a lot of people want to go to medical school. It's really hard to do good on the MCATs. It's sort of depressing, I think, when you're in college to realize, like, I want to be a doctor, but I can't.
My sister was a doctor. And my brother died right in front of me.
And you're already qualified. The courage to bear witness to death is the job. The courage to be there.
You can have the spirit of a healer, but not have the resources, the support, the pathway to becoming that in our world right now. And Station 11 is so cool to me because despite disastrous thing happening, it does open up space for people to find new ways to be what they want to be. And I think that's kind of like our pandemics, in the best stories of our pandemic, at least.
Mm-hmm, very much so. And it makes it more compelling because it's more dramatic because, you know, when Jeevan jumps on the stage, we kind of just assume he's a doctor. And the next thing you know, he calls out for a doctor. So we realize he's not a doctor. So it just really grabs your attention.
Is there a doctor anywhere?
In the house, exactly. Yeah. Well, one of the big themes that Station 11 grapples with is choice. And perhaps the biggest choice is Jeevan's decision to help a young actress and the main protagonist, Kirsten. Can you talk a bit about why you centered on that in the first episode?
I love that scene in the parking lot in episode mm-hmm. one, because it's sort of everything. It's the whole show in a lot of ways. You find yourself in a position to be morally responsible. Even if your heart is saying run and go, your moral heart is saying you can't. But at the same time, Jeevan is extremely aware of another issue, which is you can't help someone if they don't want you to help them. You can't tell someone you're going to help them. That's not right either. And she's 8, as she points out. It's an impossible situation. And he believes deeply about himself and everyone. They should choose what they want to do. It should be your choice what you do. So they're stuck for a second there, and they almost go their separate ways. But then Jeevan has an idea that is sort of a beautiful, gentle little fiction.
Your parents just messaged me. I messaged them earlier. I think they just got it. Turns out their car got stuck in Lake Forest. So, they want you to come with me and stay the night at Frank's. It turns out they know Frank from work things, so they're cool with it. Also, I was wrong. The world's not ending. So, that's cool.
Okay.
I love that scene so much because everyone is choosing mm-hmm. to pretend. And if you fast forward 20 years and you see a bunch of people playing dress up on stage telling a story and a bunch of people sitting in an audience watching, everybody is choosing to pretend there as well.
Yeah.
So yes. Theater oftentimes gets dressed up as fancy, as elitist, as just like Shakespeare, as like inaccessible, but as does art. But we do this every day with each other. We agree to pretend things together to solve our problems. And that's why I think choice matters. You have to agree to come.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's a very good point you made. Yeah. For those unfamiliar with the show or the novel, can you share why Kirsten is such a dynamic lead?
Well, Mackenzie Davis is my answer.
good answer.
Because she is a truly, in the true use of the word, a dynamic human being and performer, and a gigantic ball of powerful energy, able to play so many different looks. And my second corresponding answer is Matilda Lawler, a young actor who is stunningly talented and confident and able to do all of those things I just said about Mackenzie, and the two of them working together tell the story of a whole life. I love this character. I relate to this character, first and foremost. I relate to that little girl who at 8 very definitively is stating, this is what I'm going to be.
It must be hard not knowing what you want to be.
It takes a while.
Yeah. I'm 8.
Kirsten, in year 20, is still that same person, but she's powerful, she's talented, she's intelligent, she's brave, but she's dangerous.
What happened?
You killed all those bandanas.
And I think it's fun in TV when your main character is a dangerous person, or when your main character is a person who sometimes loses her temper, because we don't want to lose our temper, I think, in everyday life. But I think in TV, never knowing quite what someone's going to do makes for a very exciting feeling when you're watching a story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree with that. After the initial days battling the post-flu world, Kirsten returns to acting. She joins this traveling Shakespearean troupe, and their slogan is, survival is insufficient. Can you explain that slogan a little bit?
After our 2 years in the pandemic, I'm pretty sure I don't have to.
Yeah, that's true.
Because everyone listening right now survived. And I think we've really needed to ask ourselves, like, is this enough to be okay?
We're the Traveling Symphony. We travel for a reason. You burn the house down, then you go. Just try to make the world make sense for a minute.
It's just not enough to batten down the hatches, wait, and say, you'll be okay in 3 years. The danger there is our mental health, which we're not great at talking about in Wisconsin, I have to say. Mm-hmm. Not the top topic often of Thanksgiving dinner. But I think it's not enough to just survive. You need to laugh. You need your friends. You need your family. You need to be together with people and resetting relationships all the time and checking in and fixing it. If you messed up last time you saw a person, you need to notice it and say, oh man, he's pissed at me. Oh yeah, I said that rude thing. Oh, hey, sorry, Joe. You know, like all these little things that we usually do, we haven't been doing. And so I think we need those things to be okay. Well, hopefully we're getting them back soon.
Mm-hmm. Apparently the troupe only does Shakespeare's comedies in even years. Curiously, every even numbered episode of Station 11 deals with the Traveling Symphony timeline. Was that intentional or is that just a coincidence?
I think there's a pattern in there that you're sensing that is not a coincidence, which is that we felt for the right balance in the show. We needed to kind of go back and forth in our episodes, but also the Traveling Symphony takes a second to get used to. I'll put it that way. I think they're different. They're living in a different world. Post-pans in particular are like aliens, and they're kind of loosey-goosey and a little bit hippie, and they're into theater, and it just takes a second, I think, to settle in and get to know them. And so what I always thought was that, you know, episode one, that's our time. We can relate to that. Episode three, the same. Episode five, Clark is sort of a flawed character, but those are the three that are the, here's what happened in this place on the day the world fell apart episodes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it takes a little while, hopefully, if it works for people. Episode 10 is the episode where we finally feel like, okay, year 20 is the now. All that stuff that happened in those odd episodes, that was before. This is the world now. And I think it takes that much time to settle into the idea of this new way of living for us to emotionally connect most with Kirsten as an adult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I understood that you also felt that you had to inject some humor into the series, which can get pretty heavy. How did you manage to do that without undercutting the drama?
Well, I think it's always a good idea to make fun of your own pretentiousness when you're mm-hmm. trying to make a high-minded TV show. It's quite good to take a step back and roll your eyes at yourself. And so when Jeevan, who's never liked the graphic novel, in a moment later in the story has an opportunity to say what he thinks about it in a surprising time, that's very fun. And I think Clark is a very fun, sarcastic, self-destructive character. And I think watching people like Jim Phelps in episode three go golfing instead of admitting that the world is ending.
All right, you probably heard about the collapse of civilization, right? I'm going to try to sneak in 18 before they realize the world isn't actually ending. What are you doing this afternoon?
We all know people who are still actually right now saying there isn't a pandemic. And I think there's ways to be gentle about having fun with everyone who's going through something hard. But I also just, I don't know. I like my TV to have a little bit of laughter no matter what. I don't think you're allowed to do a difficult and painful story unless you have the courage to crack a joke now and then too.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. And I really love the playful homages to the Big Lebowski and Planes, Trains, and Automobiles in the Clark episode at the airport. Those
yeah.
Very, very clever and fun.
I'm a big fan of those too. Clark never gets the references. I love that too. Clark has no idea what those references are.
Could you tell me where the car rental desk is?
No cars, everything's rented.
I need to get to Chicago.
Well, okay, Steve Martin. Let me call John Candy. We'll get you both back home for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, there are a lot of parallels between the world of Station 11 and our current situation. How do you think this changes the way audiences experience the show?
I think that it's just easier to relate. You know, we started before the pandemic and we kind of just kept going. But in a lot of these, you know, I think there's feelings that we hoped the audience would feel based on kind of the math. But now I know when Clark is looking out that window with Shay at the Gitche Gumee plane and she's saying, they're sick in there. and if they come in here, we're going to get sick. And they both look at each other. I know what that feels like. I've walked down the street with a person coming on the sidewalk without a mask, and I've gone on the other side, or in the time when none of us had masks, I'd gone around the other side. Like, I know the feeling of not wanting to be close to someone because they might get me sick. And that wasn't present in my consciousness in 2019, but I'm pretty sure it's stuck in there forever now.
Yeah, I would think so. Yeah, that's the same way for me too. Your Twitter bio says Wisconsin blood, and you mentioned Green Bay. Is that where you were born?
I was born and raised in Green Bay, and I went to Madison for college.
Right, and we couldn't help but notice a few Wisconsin Easter eggs in Station 11.
Oh, yeah,
which you're doing?
Of course it is my doing. Which ones did you see?
Well, there was Jeevan wearing a UW sweater in the apartment, and then there's a pregnant woman sporting a Green Bay Packers jersey, and of course the series does take place in the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, I think the whole show is sort of a love letter to the Great Lakes region, and this is where I'm from. This is where I grew up. I grew up looking out east across Lake Michigan. I know the feeling of looking at one of the Great Lakes and not being able to see the horizon on either to my left or my right or forward. And why wouldn't you think that was an ocean 500 years ago? And I'm just in love with this part of the world where we come from. And I think the novel was originally set in Toronto, but most of the novel takes place in Michigan. And I just wanted to tell a story set in my home.
Absolutely. Patrick Somerville, thank you very much for joining us today, and congratulations on Station 11.
Thanks so much for having me.
Wisconsin native Patrick Somerville is a novelist and the creator and showrunner of HBO's Station 11. You can find out more about Patrick and Station 11 at WPR.org/beta. The abstract poet prominent
like Shakespeare. I see a homeless child on the street, I feel empathy for that child. I see 1,000 homeless children on the street, empathy breaks down.
Coming up, Fargo creator Noah Hawley joins us to talk about his novel, Anthem. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
First of all, your author would like to apologize for the world he's created. He knows it's ridiculous. The fact that the world he lives in is also ridiculous is no excuse. The author's job is to make sense of the senseless, to create coherence from incoherence. But if the author's job is also to reflect reality as he perceives it onto the page, then what is he meant to do when the world he lives in loses all sense? Consider this. As he writes, 34% of his neighbors have gone to war against tiny pieces of fabric worn across the nose and mouth. They believe these tiny pieces of fabric are robbing them of their personal freedom. And so they have declared war against these pieces of fabric, even as scientists present evidence that those same tiny pieces of fabric will protect them from a deadly virus sweeping the globe, killing millions. But for the 34%, the fabric, not the virus, is the enemy. They lay dying in hospitals from a disease they argue does not exist.
That's Noah Hawley reading an excerpt from his novel, Anthem. Noah is one of the most masterful storytellers working today in any medium. He's the creator of the FX anthology series Fargo and the executive producer for the hit Marvel TV series Legion. He's also a prolific novelist. Anthem is Noah's sixth book. It's the gripping, suspenseful story of a group of young people on a quest. When they join forces with a man whose sister is being held captive by a billionaire known as the Wizard, their quest turns into a rescue mission. Hawley has bottled our complicated societal anxiety and turned it into a literary thriller.
One of the things that I had to do in thinking about this story, which started out to be a novel about characters and ended up being a novel about a time and place, which is America and at this moment, involved, you know, in 2018, 2019, trying to think two or three steps ahead to what America would be like in 2022. You know, one of the things that was very clear and one of the things that the book is about is the sort of spiraling anxiety
in adults, but also in our children. We have spent the last 5-10 years, you know, in an increasing state of anxiety about the world. Whatever your personal, political, religious beliefs, I think we can say that we're all more on edge than we used to be. And our children feel that. And unfortunately, anxiety is a form of mental illness. And as mental illness increases, you know, suicide becomes something we really have to watch out for. And so in thinking about a kind of catalyst to push this book forward, this idea of the contagiousness of suicide, you know, it's an idea like any other idea, that became a driving force of the book, that something was happening to our children and our characters had to spring into action to try to save the day.
Mm-hmm. Since we're here in Wisconsin, we have to ask you about the first case of the suicide epidemic that people noticed. Brad Carpenter in Madison, Wisconsin. Was there a story that inspired this?
Poor Brad. No. There is no underlying deep meaning to Brad's residing in Wisconsin, other than that it's a beautiful place to live and a senseless place to pass.
Mm, very well said, yeah. One of the most surprising things that you do in Anthem is to occasionally interrupt your story to address the reader directly as the author of the book. Why did you decide to do this?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. One, as I tried to figure out how to put this story together, my mind went back to when I first read Slaughterhouse-Five, which was the Kurt Vonnegut novel about his World War II experience. Kurt, in that book and in many subsequent books, inserted himself as the storyteller on the page as a way to kind of interact directly with the reader and to say, bear with me, I'm doing the best that I can. These are hard things to talk about. What I didn't want to do is to hide behind my story. I wanted it to be clear to the reader, you know, I'm worried, and I know you're worried. I'm worried about my kids, I'm worried about my country, and I know that you feel the same way. I'm worried about the planet and climate change and all of these things. And so I'm going to tell you the story to kind of try to explain what I'm worried about, where I think the problems come from, and what we might do to solve them. But let's do it through a story, because the last thing you need is another pundit that will only make you more anxious.
Hmm. Yeah, it's very frightening how much Anthem captures the absurdity of the world we currently live in. And to riff off a sentence in your book, what kind of collateral damage of living a life of the mind have you experienced by writing the book?
You know, the work that I've done on Fargo set me up for a way of looking at the world, right? And, you know, as I developed the seasons 2 and 3 and 4 of Fargo, I really started to think about this formula in which irony without humor is just violence, right? You think about a Kafka story in which a man is on trial for a crime. They won't even tell him what it is, right? And it's a joke, but the punchline is him. It's not funny, right? And, you know, in the reading I did about the world is ridiculous, I'm not saying there's anything humorous about it. I'm saying we've reached the level of absurdity that is beyond humor. Every day you listen to the news and you think you can't make this stuff up, whether it's the sort of cosplay insurrection of the QAnon shaman or the MyPillow guy as the closest person to the president. You know, there's a certain ridiculousness to life right now that is hard to process, because it's not, you know, serious problems have serious solutions, but absurd problems, what solutions do those have? And I don't think we ever thought to prepare an answer for that.
Yeah. You also include elements of magical realism in Anthem. Was this a way to give yourself a break from writing about such dark subject matter?
Well, it's certainly a way, as Gabriel Garcia Marquez discovered, to turn something ugly into something beautiful. To take tragedy, the sort of multi-generational tragedies of 100 years of solitude, and create something beautiful out of it. But there was also this line, you know, there's a character, a 15-year-old boy who calls himself the prophet, and he quotes these statistics saying that, you know, 30-plus% of Americans believe that angels and demons walk among us. And he's asked, well, do you believe that that's real? And he says, well, I believe that the more people believe it's real, the realer it becomes. In other words, that the level of magical thinking that Americans are doing is making the world a more magical place. And that boundary between reality and fantasy breaks down in this book, as it feels like it's been breaking down in our lives.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of breakdown and the prophet, something else that the prophet says at one point in your book is, the land we call America is having a nervous breakdown. So I'm curious, what do you think it's going to take to recover from this nervous breakdown, or is it too late?
I mean, there are smarter people than me who are really trying to figure that question out. But I guess one of the things that I would say is we suffer from a deep lack of respect between people with differing opinions. And we used to have that phrase, agree to disagree, right? Which is a very respectful phrase. It's like, you believe what you believe and I believe what I believe. And I'm not saying that your beliefs are any less than mine. They're just not the same as mine. And let's agree to disagree. I think the problem becomes when there's two things. I mean, the first is satire, right? And I love watching Seth Meyers or Stephen Colbert or John Oliver, any of the great satirists of our moment. But I'm not sure that making fun of people is getting us any closer to each other. It might be an easy joke, but I don't think that it's helping. And, you know, at the same time, describing people who don't believe what you believe as evil, that's not helping either.
Mm-hmm. In his latest book, The Story Paradox, Jonathan Gottschall argues that storytelling can bind people together, but it can also tear people apart. And that's kind of something you just addressed, albeit kind of subtly. But was that something you thought about in terms of finding the right balance between optimism and pessimism for the tone of Anthem?
Yeah, you know, I talk a lot in that sort of end of the book about empathy and how empathy is a very, you know, it's sort of the best worst solution, because empathy is a very powerful force if we're talking about one or two people. I see a homeless child on the street, I feel empathy for that child. I see 1,000 homeless children on the street, empathy breaks down. But, you know, empathy can also be manipulated, right? If you tell a large group of people that they have been victimized and things have been stolen from them, and who doesn't empathize with themselves first and foremost? And you know, when you feel like someone has been wronged, you're looking not just to comfort them, but also to catch the perpetrator of that wrong. And unfortunately, when you have people who believe they've been wronged, they're out to get justice for that wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A few years ago, you started thinking about stories visually. How did this visual thinking inform your creative process while working on Anthem, or did it?
I think there's two ways that we interact with stories. One is intellectually and the other is emotionally, right? And, you know, you think of a David Foster Wallace description of anything, you know, with footnotes, et cetera, et cetera. You know, the precision of that description is very intellectually satisfying, but not necessarily as emotionally moving as something that feels more visual, right? Because when you see it, then the reader brings emotion to it. That's where the visual style for my writing really comes from is, you know, I don't want you to just understand it, I want you to feel it. And it's a collaboration between you and I, the writer, and you, the reader, is I'll paint the picture and you have the feelings. And, you know, so that's been my approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've read that radio scripts from shows like the BBC Radio's The Goon Show and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy have helped you to broaden your view about what storytelling can be. How so?
Well, you think about, it's similar to reading, but you think about listening to a story. There's sort of no more visual experience for me than listening to a story. My head is full of images, you know, and something like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which was a very comedic, creative, inventive science fiction story, it took your brain to these places that you hadn't imagined before. And it's, on some level, it's why the filmed adaptations have been so underwhelming, is because the pictures that you see in your head are so personal. and no one else's interpretation can really match what you see in your head.
In the epilogue of Anthem, you talk about how your daughter, Guinevere, asked you how you were going to end the book. What did you tell her?
Well, I mean, what I say in the book, as I said, beats me. We had been talking about, she was studying World War I, and she's 14, and she was asking me about it. And I said, well, you can't really talk about World War I without talking about World War II, right? Which is that things don't really end. They just lead to other things. And so the ending of a story is always a kind of artifice. But, you know, in this book, you know, which is about this quest that these young people go on, the question is, are they going to be okay? And I thought it was all right to say as the author, I hope so, but I don't know. I'm worried. I'm worried about these kids. I'm worried about my kids. But look what they've accomplished so far. The odds are good that they'll be okay, but it's hard to know. We're right at this tipping point. Unfortunately, we can't see the horizon yet of how our kids are going to be when they grow up. But that's always been the case with parenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You're working on a series for FX based on the Alien movie franchise. And the central question that you're exploring is, does humanity deserve to survive? It seems to me that this could also be one of the questions you explored in Anthem. What do you think?
I know. You know, here's the thing. I'm a pretty cheerful guy. You know, I'm a big believer in making the best of things. So it's starting to sound, from your questions, like I'm not. Like I'm pessimistic. Like
yeah, I'm sorry. Pessimist. I'm painting. Yeah. Yeah,
but I think the reality is these are critical questions that we need to explore. And on some level, it's best if optimists explore them because they're always going to come out on the side of humanity. But yeah, I mean, I think that the question, you know, one of the things that I loved the most about the first two Alien movies is that they weren't just monster movies, right? There were movies about humanity trapped between the sort of primordial parasitic past and this artificial intelligence future, and both are trying to kill us. So we're sort of trapped. We can't go forward and we can't go back, and how are we going to get out of this mess? And that seemed interesting to me. If it was just a bug hunt and we're on the run, I don't know what to do with that, because even if the show is 60% of the best action and horror you've ever seen, there's still 40%, what are we talking about? What's the show about? And so that requires thematic levels of ideas that are built into it. And I think that setup really provides that for me.
Mm-hmm. Noah Hawley, thank you very much for taking time to talk to us, and congratulations on Anthem. It's a very powerful, timely, and provocative book.
Thank you.
Noah Hawley is the creator of Fargo and the author of the novel Anthem. You can find out more about Noah and his book at WPR.org/beta.
He apparently almost got Elton John, and then Elton John recommended his friend Cat Stevens and suggested that his music might be more suitable.
Coming up, author Heidi Greco talks about one of her all-time favorite films, Harold and Maude. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1971, the movie Harold and Maude was released. It starred Bud Cort and Ruth Gordon in what could well be their most memorable roles. The film combines black comedy with drama to give us a new way to think about life, love, and age. And it features a memorable soundtrack by Yusuf Islam, probably better known to you as Cat Stevens. More than 50 years after its release, Harold and Maude still holds up. Just ask my fellow British Columbian, Heidi Greco. She's the author of Glorious Birds, a celebratory homage to Harold and Maude. Heidi says that this movie is one of a kind in the genre of unconventional romances.
The main way that it is unconventional is the fact that Maude is pretty well four times Harold's age. She's about to turn 80 and he is about 20. It's never specified exactly. And I cannot think of another film where such a huge age difference occurs, but I do point out, and it will always bother me, that in our culture, it's perfectly acceptable for an 80-year-old man to have a 21-year-old piece of eye candy female on his arm, but the other way doesn't work.
Exactly. How were Bud Cort and Ruth Gordon cast as Harold and Maude?
He was bold enough to declare when he went for the tryout for it to say bluntly to Hal Ashby, "Hi, I'm your guy." And Ashby, I guess, was charmed by that. Ashby had noticed him before because Cort had been in two Altman films. Cort fit Ashby's parameters. With Ruth Gordon, it was not as smooth. Ashby went to England and actually considered Dame Edith Evans, whom I just could not picture as Maude whatsoever. When Ruth Gordon got the job, it was definitely an improvement, at least as far as I'm concerned. She was worldly. She oozed sexuality, despite being mid-70s, which is what she actually was then. And she was believable as someone that a young man as unique as Harold might fall in love with.
Harold loves Maude. And Maude loves Harold.
The film opens with a series of Harold's fake attempts to commit suicide. Can you talk about these scenes and what kind of emotional impact they had on you the first time you saw Harold and Maude?
You know, I'm not sure that it was the suicides that really did it for me. The thing that I think is the most important about the first suicide, in quotes, is the fact that the film begins with it, and that the film begins in darkness. Harold appears only feet first, walking down the stairs in quite a dark afternoon, and then he lights candles, and they're the only illumination. And I can't help but think that one of the reasons this film came out at solstice in December 20th of 1971, almost solstice, is that the whole film proceeds from darkness to light.
Don't be shy, just let your feelings roll on by. Don't wear fear, or nobody will know you're there.
Let's talk a bit about director Hal Ashby. What did he bring to the film, in your opinion?
Well, he brings that wonderful, his vision of a world that will be filled with peace and love, rather than one that is filled with war and hate. I love the little touches that he does, where he does his little Hitchcock cameos in the films. He was a visionary, and he did things his own way. Yet another inspiration to me to do things my own way.
That's great, yeah. Yeah, you mentioned the anti-war content. Can you talk a bit more about that, about the anti-war content that we see in Harold and Maude?
The most poignant scene is when the camera pulls back on a veteran's graveyard, those anonymous, terribly anonymous-looking white gravestones, and the camera pulls back and back and back and back and back until we're viewing thousands of graves of veterans. If that isn't a powerful statement against war, I can't imagine it being interpreted any other way. And of course, when Harold manages to get out of the draft, everything about the scene is ironic because Maude is helping him. She's carrying a peace sign, which he grabs and chases her with it, wielding the peace sign as a weapon. And then Harold is finally excused from military service because he is clearly too rabid about his own violent actions. So He's too ready to kill to be able to go to the military to kill.
Will they really teach me to shoot?
Sure they will. A variety of weapons.
To use a bayonet?
Yes!
How about hand-to-hand combat?
Yes!
To strangle someone, choke him, squeeze out his life in your own bare hands.
I think you're getting carried away, Harold. How about
the music for Harold and Maude was composed and performed by Yousaf Islam, alias the artist formerly known as Cat Stevens. And you say that the soundtrack serves as connective tissue to the film from the first scene to the last. That's a huge accomplishment. How did Cat Stevens do that?
The quote is actually one that was applied originally to The Graduate and to the way that the Simon and Garfunkel soundtrack worked for that. And I believe that that was inspiration for Ashby wanting to find the same kind of unified soundtrack to hold his film together. He apparently almost got Elton John, and then Elton John recommended his friend Cat Stevens and suggested that his music might be more suitable. Cat Stevens chose tunes from two previously published albums, but then there were two gaps in the soundtrack, and Cat Stevens had to write two more songs, both of which he thought weren't ready, but Ashby liked them as they were, and they turn out to be the If You Want to Sing Out, Sing Out, which is kind of the theme song for the film and its philosophy.
Well, if you want to sing out, sing out. And if you want to be free, be free. Because there's a million things to be, you know that there are.
Ashby convinced Cat Stevens that they worked as they were, that there was something about their rawness.
You end the book by saying you can't help but think the movie inspired you and helped you be brave enough to become the person you are today. Can you talk a bit more about how it made you brave?
1971 was barely the beginning of environmentalism as a public force. Obviously, people had been concerned about the environment, you know, much previously, but it was becoming big. Greenpeace was founded in Vancouver in 1971. Mm-hmm. Maude's rescuing the little tree and taking it to the forest, appreciating the earth.
Look at it. Oh, it's suffocating. Well, it's the smog. You know, people can live with it, but trees, it gives them asthma. They can't breathe.
Huh?
The leaves, look, they're turning brown. Harold, we have got to do something about this light.
What?
All of those philosophies were imprinted on me, and the film told me that it was okay to care about such things. At that time, it was going against the grain. It was going against the grain even for women to wear pants to work. The times were very different. Women had a place, and it was beneath, behind men. And yeah, this film told me that it was okay to be weird, and it was okay to stand up for what you believe.
Yeah, and those are important things to learn. Has writing this book changed the way you think about Harold and Maude?
It's crystallized it, you know, because I had to put it into words, but I don't love it any less. It may have not held up as well if it hadn't been for Chuck Melville, again, one of the directors, insisting that it be cut down because originally it was 3 hours long. And as he remarks, he said, oh, my God, you know, like if you'd had to hear Maude pontificate about one of her pet things one more time, you know, like you just wanted to scream. So fortunately, I think that that's probably when Ashby stepped in to help make the cutting more extreme than it had been to that point. And tight editing is clearly one of the reasons that it endures.
Mm. Heidi Greco, thank you very much for joining us today, and congratulations on Glorious Birds, a celebratory homage to Harold and Maude. Heidi Greco is a poet, editor, critic, and the author of Glorious Birds, a celebratory homage to Harold and Maude. Find out more at wpr.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Patrick Somerville, Noah Hawley, and Heidi Greco. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, click on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You actually got better after the world ended.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Why do we need a leader at all?
And thanks to you, our allies. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
Your celebrity's a little less relevant in a post-apocalyptic context.